morning. We are convening today's House Revenue Committee. Welcome, everyone. Today we have a number of things on our agenda. We're going to take it pretty much in order, I think, and we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 20. Mazin, do you want to remind us about Senate Bill 20?
Chair Berger, members of the committee, Senate Bill 20,
is the bond bill.
The bonding bill, exactly.
That rewrites, concerned with law commission rewrite of bonds, aligning some statute, and...
Yes.
Conforms with property tax timelines. I'm reading from my notes on this bill.
It primarily does that, and they have, that's it.
Yeah, this has to do with the refunding bonds, and it's conforming statutes and some timeline issues that have to do with conforming with federal.
Yes. Well, and also allowing us for slightly different timelines for the appeal process or the objection process.
Exactly.
If there's a concern, it doesn't feel like a policy change. It feels like a technical clarification and change on that timeline. And I think the effect of it is to shorten some of those timelines.
And there are no expenditure impacts and no revenue impacts.
Well, if I could, Madam Chair, there could very easily be expenditure impacts on those who refinance the bond because their interest rates presumably will go down, and they either will pay off the bond faster or they will reduce their annual expenditures to pay the bond.
I'm reading from our paperwork. Our fiscal paperwork, Chair.
There's no impact on the state, at least not directly.
Okay, and no revenue impact according to our paperwork. Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
You like to move this?
Oh, yes. Madam Chair, thank you for giving me my cue. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 20 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I guess I should say 20A.
Representative Barnhart moves Senate Bill 20A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any other comments, questions? I'll call for a roll vote.
Representative Dent.
Aye.
Representative Gelter.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Bond.
Aye.
Representative Bailey.
Excused.
Representative Brewer.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barnhart.
Aye.
Co-Chair Berger.
Aye. The motion passes. Thank you very much. Carrier, anybody dying to talk about? Representative Juan volunteers. Okay. Thank you, Representative Juan. And the carrier is Representative Juan. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 20A and open a work session on Senate Bill 322A. Christine's coming forward. We heard this just a couple of days ago, members of the committee. This concerns itself with mixed-use housing.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 322A has a minimal expenditure impact, and the revenue impact of the bill is a small portion of the $6.6 million total loss in property taxes, and it would ramp up if this exemption were to expire to the full amount within a number of years. The exemption, the sunset actually would stop the new applications, so the existing applications or the existing exemptions would mature, and then this would extend that sunset from January 1st, 2012 to January 1st, 2022, and it just extends the multiple unit housing tax exemption to the value of any commercial spaces to the extent that they're required as design or public benefit elements by the city or county as part of the multi-unit construction.
Okay, questions about this bill? Yes, Representative Benz.
Madam Chair, I don't have so much a question as a concern. The nature of the credit is such that it's mingled and mangled and diluted, and this is a further dilution of an already difficult to trace the impact of tax credit. I've spent more time than I should have looking at it, and it's with some degree of hesitancy that I will support it. I must say, though, it is hard to trace out the value of this tax credit.
I share your concerns. I will say that in talking to the communities who are interested in this, they feel that it is a valuable sort of piece in their toolboxes, that they admit it may not be the biggest piece in their toolboxes, but one that they feel is helpful on a number of levels. But I agree with you. It is the state impact is not here. It's the local governments and their ability to use this in some way. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will be supporting this bill. I think it is a good and important bill, but the issue raised by Representative Benz and what you just mentioned is an important one. I think it's easy for us sometimes when we look at property tax credits and policy decisions that impact property tax collections through a more generous lens than we do those that impact our own general fund. We have a very complicated property tax system. I think it's one that many people do not understand particularly well, and it's something that deeply impacts our schools, our counties, and our cities, and should always have very careful consideration from us. And I hope in the interim, this discussion came up the other day, that we can spend some time really delving into our property tax system and how that's impacting our local governments and what tools we might be able to give them here.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You may remember from our previous discussion of this, I was interested in the sort of definitions of public benefit. I've had some discussions with some of the advocates since then, and what's clear is that there's a lot of work yet to do in defining what is and isn't a public benefit. It sounds like the local jurisdictions are engaged in that, and I think we will do well if this bill moves forward to invite them back and have some more discussion about how that's defined. Perhaps there's some lessons for other uses for us.
Thank you, Representative. Further comments? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Senate Bill 322 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barnhart moves Senate Bill 322A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Without further comment, I'll ask for a roll call.
Representative Benz.
Aye.
Representative Gelson.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative Bailey.
Excused.
Representative Brewer.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barnhart.
Aye.
Co-Chair Berger.
Aye. Motion passes. Carrier, Representative Gelser would like to carry this. Thank you very much. And with that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 322A. And we will now move to House Bill 2519 with amendments. Let's see.
Chairberger and members of the committee, I'm back.
Always happy to see you, Mazin.
Likewise. That 2519, just to remind you, refresh your memory, it was a bill about one issue, and now it was the first complete change, got unstuffed type of bill. This was used by the -1 amendment to align some of the language on some of the issues that were concerning the 2010 session in regard to the credit unions and the public deposits and the definitions, and putting some meat and definitions around these issues that probably with the introduction of the law in 2010 were not completely flushed out. So this is what the Dash 1 does, and also there is latest the Dash 2 that primarily talks and introduces the concept of the Oregon Development and Finance Authority and how the, it is structured and how it works. And I think the co-chair is
okay. Members of the committee, this particular bill, as you see, started out to be something else in our committee. I believe it was a committee bill. It was not heard. It was a vehicle used by the treasurer to do some technical changes that they felt the need of, and the bill fit. It was not going to be used in another way. So those are the dash ones. The dash twos are new to us, and it basically puts into this bill the idea of the Economic Development Finance Authority, which has been heard and has been under consideration in a number of ways, and Representative Barnhart has been his champion, and I think he's the best person to explain it to the committee. So thank you, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Barnhart, House District 11. The part of the bill, pages 1 through 7 on the dash 2s, we've already heard. I'm not going to talk about them. The rest of it, starting with Section 6, is identical to the dash 11 amendments on House Bill 3452. I've been having a long conversation with the Treasury about the problem of dealing with the small sort of orphan accounts that we have set up over the years to deal with economic development. And there are a number of them scattered around in our finance system. Most of them have independent boards. Many of them are only marginally effective. And then one of the big reasons why they're only marginally effective is because there isn't any coordination between them. What this bill does is set up a skeleton for the beginning of some work on establishing some coordination among these funds. And they're funds like the Oregon Growth Account, the portion of the PERS account, which is intended for economic development in Oregon. Obviously, we're talking about a very, very large fund, $57 billion, most of which is invested generally. But a very small portion of that has been earmarked for Oregon investment. And then there's some other funds also scattered around. And one of the issues, I think, is that because these are small, it's difficult to kind of attend to them in a way that actually promotes a general policy of economic development in Oregon. On the other side, we have Oregon Business Department that every once in a while comes up against a problem that they don't seem to be able to manage, having to do with support for businesses that either want to move to Oregon, would like to stay in Oregon, would like to grow here. And so it occurred to us, not just me, but also the Treasury, that it would make sense to build an Oregon, a small one, intended to start the process of pulling the administration of these funds together. Now, there's some sort of basic sidewalls that we kept on this bill to make it more comfortable for the legislature, and also because it would be extremely complicated for us to breach any of those sidewalls. And the most important one is that current conditions under which the funds can be used are not affected at all by this bill. So the risk issues that the legislature has already addressed around these funds will not change. They still have to comply with all of the rules that we established and the rules of the various boards and agencies that control the funds now. What we did do was establish a small authority made up of the treasurer, the governor or their designees, and an appointee, at least at least no more than two of which can be members of the same political party. And I'll refer you to, if I can find it here.
Page 10.
Page 10, thank you. Sort of the top of the page. And I refer you particularly to big C and small b below that. It also establishes an advisory board, which is made up of bankers, credit union officials, farmers, small business people, and others. And the list is in here again. And I'm very familiar with the other form of this thing, so...
This is page 12.
Thank you. Page 12. I'm glad somebody has figured out the new page numbers. Financial sector, small business, building trades, and small farms. Two members must be officers of banks, and at least two members must be officers of credit unions. And the point of this is to get this authority to start working with these other boards that I've talked about to reach agreements, we hope, that will allow the Oregon Business Development to manage the investment in Oregon of these funds in accordance with the current rules that they have. Finally, at the end of the bill, it requires the authority to report to the legislature to tell us whether they think the idea works and whether it ought to continue or not past 2015, and also to let us know what their progress is and whether or not they think we need changes in other laws, and if so, specifically what those are. So it contemplates the possibility of some changes in the sideboards on some of the funds, but it doesn't do that, and it does not authorize the authority to do that either. They would have to come back to the legislature and ask so that we keep complete control over the risk issues. The advantage of this thing, if it works, is we'll end up with a system that focuses our resources rather than having them be scattered.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Probably a very obvious question that should have already identified, but the Representative Barnhart, you mentioned the recommendations for beyond 2015. Does that mean that there's a sunset on
no.
somewhere else?
Well, thank you, Representative Reed, Madam Chair. Material on page 13, number 2, line 7, recommendations for legislation that are related to the duties and policies of the authority, including a recommendation as to whether the authority should continue to exist beyond 2015. So they have to explicitly come in and tell us whether they think that this effort is worth it. And one presumes that this is a 31 and 16. One presumes that if they say it's not worth doing, it will be repealed.
Representative Pence.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we have any idea of how many of these state funds there are that this would apply to?
I think if we asked the Treasurer to come forward, the Treasurer's office, we could get a better, and he is coming forward later. So if you like to hold the question.
I'm happy to hold the question.
Further questions? Representative Barnhart, we'll take you off the hook, and we'll
okay.
ask Mr. Salvaggio to come forward. I'm going to ask the representatives from the credit unions and the banks to weigh in, if you will, but we'll let Mr. Salvaggio speak first. I'm just warning you. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer. The short answer to Representative Benson's question through the chairs, I don't know precisely how many of these various threads will eventually be pulled together. I don't know how many are out there. I know that we have various funds as a state within Business Oregon. I know that Treasury has the Oregon Growth Account, the Oregon Investment Fund. I know that there are various lottery funds, and eventually the authority that's set up is going to have to decide what we want to consider threads that should be pulled together. For instance, the Department of Energy has the Small Energy Loan Program. Should that be considered economic development? Should that be pulled in with this under the same strategic framework? That's a question that I can't answer right here at this in this committee, but that the authority would be able to bring their experience and decision-making abilities and the expertise of the advisory board to bear and make that kind of determination at that point. The impetus for this is that we recognize that there are many little funds floating out there, and that we recognize that we do need a wider 50,000 foot view to say this is the type of fund that should be brought in here, and make those decisions at a higher level with a broader strategic framework.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The guess my question is this: is the purpose of this to gather together a bunch of similarly situated accounts, manage them for purpose of safety, or is it to gather together these disparate accounts and use them for investment purposes, or is it a combination of all those? I'm just interested in knowing kind of the scope of what we're about, and then why it makes our system better.
Certainly. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the purpose, I think, is an amalgamation of what you just described, in that currently we have these disparate accounts that may or may not be marching in the same direction, so to speak. I'll give you a concrete example, so and answer your question that way. I had recently the experience of speaking with a company from Portland who came to Treasury because they were in need of a participation loan from the state. And this was going to be quite lucrative for them, as it was the determination as to whether they received an out-of-state contract or not. They had gone to Business Oregon and identified some funds that could potentially help them out, which had been exhausted by that point. They came to Treasury to ask if we had any funds available, so we reviewed their requirements and what their profile was like, and determined that that really didn't fit into any of our particular areas. And as I was considering what other opportunities might be out there in other agencies for them, it turned out that I called Business Oregon to kind of powwow with my opposite number over there, and that particular fund that would have applied to them had been financially recharged since then, and luckily we were able to coordinate that and tell the company, you should go back to Business Oregon at this point because there are resources there again for you. But without that complex phone tree that essentially happened almost happenstance, there's no telling what might have transpired there, and whether the company just might have lost interest, or whether that fund may not have been available. But it appeared to us that there needed to be some kind of unified strategy, so that they went to one place, one authority, and they could say, here are the options in front of you, and they could see all of the all of these funds and all of these options and all of these financial routes under one roof and under one strategy, so that there wasn't the need to kind of throw darts at a dartboard while blindfolded, so to speak.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you. The question, I guess, I was trying to get at what the mission of this organization is. Is it to gather together these monies and hold them in one place for the availability of those who were, so it's still there when the other folks need it? Or is it to gather together one place to have it available to utilize in the way that these other groups were to have utilized it? There's that keep it safe for me savings component, and then there's the take it and go invest it component. I'm just trying to get at which it is that this is supposed to be doing.
Certainly. Through the chair, is Representative Vence's question. The current legislation is quite clear. As Representative Barnhart pointed out earlier, we are not changing any of these existing sideboards. This is simply to coordinate the strategy and communication between these funds, and bring it under the same strategic framework. There is no there's no plan to amalgamate these into one large super fund, so to speak, and invest that as a single fund. The individual sideboards and the individual accounts will be kept discrete, though more strategically unified. Does that get at your
Paula?
Yes.
I'm just reminded of working with a charitable organization that was funded with any number of grants, each with its own set of rules, each of which required its own set of bookkeeping, and the each of which had its own set of criteria when making an expenditure. Is this a similar arrangement?
Madam Chair, Representative Vince, currently this is a similar arrangement. If the beauty, as I see it, of this authority and advisory board is that if this, if we go forward under that strategy and we feel, gosh, this isn't really working out for us, it should be more unified on the books, or we should be able to be more flexible in terms of these sideboards. That's something that the an industry-driven advisory board and the actual authority can get together and determine this is not really working for the interests of economic development in the state, and thusly we're going to recommend that that we alter that in ways X, Y, or Z that I can't think of right now because I haven't had that experience yet. But currently, they would be the funds would be kept discreet, the funds would be held to their existing sideboards, and then the authority and the advisory council would be able to determine whether that was the most effective use of this ability.
Thank you.
Well, let me add to that answer, if I may. The authority doesn't have any capacity to actually change the sideboards. They would have to come back to the legislature to do that.
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, that's correct. I neglected to mention that.
Further questions? We do not have all the paperwork on this, members of the committee, so this will be carried over till Friday. So if you have further questions or want more information, the folks are available to talk to you about it, and I would like to invite the banks and the credit unions to come forward and give us their take on this iteration.
I must stay here separate, you guys.
Chair Berger, members of the committee, I'm Pam Levitt with the Northwest Credit Union Association. We do support both the Dash 1 and the Dash 2 amendments. We've been certainly working with Representative Barnhart during the whole concept of this Finance Authority Board and have reviewed all of the many amendments and changes and support what he has proposed in the Dash 2 amendment. I will just remind you that last session we passed legislation to allow credit unions to accept public funds over the federal deposit insurance amount of $250,000. That law does not go into effect until January of 2013. So as soon as session ends, we'll be working with the Treasurer's Office to set up all of the requirements and funding. That's actually part of the Dash 1 amendment that you are reviewing. But we certainly think that this Finance Authority Board will be helpful as and credit unions will be available to help communities and certainly be available for these deposits. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Martinez.
Madam Co-Chair, Co-Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. For those of you that are hearing this bill for the first time, I would let you know that this bill has been vetted quite extensively. There was another version of the bill that we got all the way up to the Dash 11. So there has been a lot of work done, and I would commend Chair Barnhart and Chair Berger for their efforts on this. They put lots of hours into it, as have many others. We do support the Dash 2 amendments and the passage of the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for these folks? Thank you very, very much. Appreciate it. Is there anyone from the Oregon Economic Development? There is not. I think they're a little surprised to see. I have had conversations that they are very much in support of this concept.
That's what they've told me as well.
They didn't see it in this bill. They saw it in another venue. So without further questions, can we carry this over till Friday? And we will hold this over in work session until Friday, and I will close the work session on House Bill 2519 and open the work session on House Bill 2820, today. This one, if you recall, was from the Department of Education, and it concerned proprietary schools, as I recall.
Yes, ma'am. Chair Berger, members of the committee, House Bill 2820 with dash one amendments increases annual license fees for the career schools. Excuse me. And that applies to 11, 13 years. And then starting from 2013, the bill allows the State Board of Education to adopt by rule annual license fees for career schools and fees for certain activities related to career schools. In the packet, you have revenue impact, fiscal impact, and you have yet to adopt special amendments and also a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay, it does not yet have a subsequent, we would have to add.
Oh, yes.
We would have to add one. Is that my understanding?
Yes, yeah.
It does have the fiscal, the paperwork?
Is it the dash complete. One?
Yes.
And it is the dash one?
Yeah. All the paperwork is to dash one amendments. Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to recess the Revenue Committee until we have more members here. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to reopen the Revenue Committee, and I'm going to what do I need to do to the one that's open? Recess the work session on 2820 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2653.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2653A would allow justice courts to assign certain judgments related to criminal activities to the Department of Revenue for subsequent collection. The bill would require these courts to submit an annual report to the Legislative Fiscal Office regarding the status of their liquidated and delinquent accounts. The bill also identifies a minimum amount of information to be included in those reports. And it also would require LFO to produce an annual report, which is essentially a compilation of the reports they receive from the justice courts.
Thank you. Questions of Chris? We have a couple of folks to come forward. Alex Kyler. Might as well all come up here. Matt Marquis and Paul Snyder. Mr. Kyler.
Thank you. Co-Chair Berger, Co-Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. I'm here on House Bill 2653A to express the Board of County Commissioners' support for this measure. A little background here is that we have a Lane County employs an internal auditor. The internal auditor began to look at justice court operations specifically with regards to receivables, and I sort of got pulled into the conversation when it was when I was alerted to the fact that perhaps there was a legislative fix that that might assist the three justice courts in Lane County for improving their collections record. If you look back over about the past 7 years, we've had an average collection rate of 63% of the fines collected.
Yeah.
And the recommendation was to seek additional access to the Department of Revenue's other agencies' collection account, and that's what this bill does. The justice courts are currently limited in their access to the services provided by DOR to what's called their offset program, which is where if I, for instance, were fined and had gone through justice court but had not paid that, but the state of Oregon owed me a tax refund, that fine would be reduced from my tax refund and the money sent directly to the court. The suite of services that the courts do not currently enjoy access to is the broader level of service that the agency provides, which is their full collection service, which includes garnishment program in concert with the employment department. What I've done for the committee is put together a table that's on the backside of my testimony here, and what it does is it shows the annual amounts imposed by five courts. There are 41 courts across the state of Oregon, but this looked at five counties' experience annual imposed amount of violations, the actual collection that they were able to experience through their internal operations, their ability right now to work with DOR, and their any relationships they might have with private collection firms. And so you can sort of see the range from these five counties of what sort of experience they have with the collection rate. In the fourth column there, it assumes an 80% collection rate. This is the assumption that if the courts had this additional tool, that they may bring their collection rate up to 80%. And that's based on the experience that we've seen at DOR's other agency collection unit with regards to violations only. So if you look at DOR's entire experience with circuit court collections, it's really more in the 50-55% collection range. But when you peel out just the violations, which is the vast majority of judgments assigned by justice courts, that actually climbs to an 80% collection rate. So the final column there on the right shows the differential. On the bottom, it would, for those courts, the experience then would be $3.5 million annually of additional revenue. And due to the way that the fines have a unitary assessment or distributions in other parts of law to come to the state's general fund, the revenue to the state would be close to $1 million a year. And This simply puts justice courts really on the same footing with circuit courts in terms of having a full suite of collection services available to them. They would have, the bill is permissive, so they still can work with collectors, collection agencies. They still can do their own operations. They just have the option of utilizing additional services at Department of Revenue. And we urge a yes vote today. Thank you.
You want to finish this panel, and then we'll invite questions.
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis, representing the Oregon Collectors Association. I first want to start off by thanking Chair Barnhart. During the interim, he helped put together a work group on this issue to try and look at what the problem was among justice courts as far as what their receivables were, to try to get some more information as to what kind of problem there was across the state, how big the problem was, and how much it was growing by each year. Unfortunately, that process kind of broke down, and we didn't get that information, which leads us to the amendments that were added to the House during the House Judiciary Committee when this bill was there. We worked with Representative Nathanson to look at a way that if a justice court was going to use the Department of Revenue, that they'd have to then work with Legislative Fiscal Office to determine what kind of problem they had with their receivables by reporting, you know, their beginning and ending balance of their receivables, how much it grew by, the average size of their account, counts, those types of things, so that we can see where this is actually at. And I was glad to see with the previous testimony that they had actually started to put some of that together. That's the first time that I'd actually seen what kind of issues there were as far as where their receivables were at. So while we were fairly adamantly opposed to the original bill, we're a lot less opposed now. How is that?
Okay.
Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Marquis. We'll let the county speak, and then we'll leave you up here for questions.
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, also appearing in support of House Bill 2653A. I think Mr. Kyler has pretty much indicated all the bases for which the counties are in support of this bill. I would simply add, though, that justice courts are courts. They're courts just like circuit courts in the sense that they represent the rule of law. And to the extent that their receivables cannot be collected, that has an adverse impact on the justice system. In addition to that, this represents a revenue source for the state, for the counties, and for a number of other folks who receive funding through the criminal justice system. So it appears to us to be a win-win all the way around. We recommend the bill to you.
Thank you. Questions? From the committee. Representative Benz, I have a comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hesitate to keep asking these questions. I'm feeling...
No, Representative Benz, you're good at this.
I'm just looking at the summary, fiscal impact summary, and I note that if all of the justice courts joined this, then we would add 4 FTE to DOR. But I note in the earlier paragraph it says the cost of a collection are to be paid by the justice courts. I'm taking it that cost of a collection don't include those 4 FTE.
This may be a question for staff or
LFO
or the DOR. Don't all rush up. Sooner or later, you were going to have to come up here because I was going to get you up here if nobody else did. Because I had a similar questions.
Thank you, Chair Berger. Ken Ross with the Department of Revenue, and I was trying to hide back there.
No, between two other DOR people there, so one of you was going to be here.
So, Representative Vance, to answer your question, yes, the FTE would be included in the cost.
Hold on.
Yes.
So, if I understand correctly, then the counties would, in essence, pick this up, or how would this happen? You would. The hope is the account is assigned, the money is collected, we hope. And then from those collections, the FTE are paid for. I'm just unclear on how exactly that's going to work.
Chair Berger, Representative Benz, that is correct. We charge a percentage to pay for the administrative costs to collect, and it ranges depending the offset percentage is a lot less than the full collection percentage, but we do take a percentage out of each dollar we collect.
Yes, Representative Benz.
Is there any idea of the volume of dollars we're talking about that might be assigned from these justice courts to the department? Do we have an idea of the total outstanding unpaid accounts?
Chair Berger, Representative Mess, I'm going to defer that to someone else that might have that number.
Chair Berger, Representative Benz, I can tell you the experience in Lane County that over the past 7 years, for example, I've got data right here about the amount of fines imposed, and I think I put it in my testimony, $30 million in fines imposed, $19 million of that collected. So, you know, we've got, close to $11 million. Outstanding over the last 7 years. How much of that would be assigned is really at the discretion of the court. Some of it, my understanding is, may not be assigned to DOR if it's out of state. So that is
somewhat of a limiting factor, but otherwise there is, it's up to the court to decide what mix to assign to either a collection agency to handle in-house or to assign to the Department of Revenue under the current operations as I understand them. I did also want to comment that, at least in talking to the courts that I've talked to, I can be fairly assured that I don't think we're going to see 41 courts all of a sudden knocking on Department of Revenue's door. I think you probably see the five or six largest courts saying this is something that we ought to take a close look at.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you. The final question. The use of the term judgment suggests that the priority of the claim would fall within all other judgments that, as that term is used for those collection activities currently engaged in by the department. So that would mean then that the fact that this is a justice court judgment and the fact that it's now assigned to the department would not in any way advance the nature of that claim for justice courts. In other words, the judgment for the justice court should be identical in all respects to the circuit court judgment. And that the fact that we now give it to the DOR doesn't in any way give the counties any greater or more prioritized claim by simple virtue of having available to it collection methodologies that the DOR enjoys. Is that a correct? That would be a very lengthy question or understanding.
Don't all answer at once,
Representative Benz. That's the way I understand it. There's no prioritization that is established under this measure to suggest that these justice court judgments somehow leapfrog over other work that's occurring at DOR.
Yes.
Okay. Well, my question is actually this: the idea is that a justice court judgment in some counties, I'm not sure it's actually of record. I'm not sure it actually becomes a lien upon. I don't know the answer to this. It may not. I don't know. But the fact that we would then be able to assign it to DOR, does it suddenly then become a better judgment than it was before it was assigned to DOR? The reason I ask this question has to do with a bill we heard earlier, and it gave the DOR the opportunity to offset working with the federal government. And this will add a very large amount, $16 million more, claims to that arsenal, if you would call it that package, that heap of judgments. And I just want to make sure that we're not in some odd way improving the standing of the counties by virtue of the assignment to DOR.
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, I can take a shot at that. You're correct. Not all of these become an automatic lien from a justice court. You're absolutely correct there. I don't think it probably affects the offset, though, because they already have the ability to assign this stuff to the Department of Revenue today for offset purposes. So I don't think it's going to leapfrog them in front of anybody else because they're already assigning these accounts for the offset purpose.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you. When you open up a line of questioning and you allow me time to read some of the details in the bill, I end up with another question. Is a violation a criminal action? I'm looking at line 21, page 1. I simply don't know.
Chair Barnhart, I have looked at that, and my understanding is that a violation is a criminal action.
So the intent of the bill, then, if I may, Madam Chair, the intent of the bill, then, is to allow the assignment, if they want, of the bulk of the uncollected work. And I suspect that in justice courts, most of that is violation, fines based on violations.
That's correct. Yes, sir.
Okay. One other, if I could make a comment, and perhaps Representative Nathanson was going to make a comment like this. One of the issues that I think we know about, based on the one work group meeting that we had, I think last year, if I remember correctly, is that some justice courts are very, 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 very well managed in terms of keeping their books up to date and ready to use. Others may be more relaxed in their operations, and passing a bill like this is sort of an intermediate step, it seems to me, Because one of the questions that I suspect, if this thing actually does collect some money, one of the things I suspect that some judiciary committee or revenue committee later on would ask is, what's happened to the rest of them? And at that point, the issue of how relaxed the books are might come up again.
Comment?
Chair Barnhart? The amendment that that Matt spoke to that came in judiciary was fully supported by Lane County, by Justice Lemhouse, who was involved with this. We agree that we had tried, as a result of the work group, to put together, we did put together an electronic survey for the courts to respond to some of these questions about outstanding fines. And we had very poor response. So I think your statements are accurate, and I believe the language inserted in judiciary does improve the measure. It does give additional accountability and oversight, and I think that's a positive thing for the justice court system as a whole.
Thank you. If I could just follow
up.
The point, if I understand the bill, I think that I do, it basically requires a report to be made, but only by those courts that actually use the law, and the law doesn't require them to be it to be used.
Okay. Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Chair, that is correct, and I think it's important to know that just because somebody doesn't report or doesn't use Department of Revenue doesn't mean that their books are necessarily in shambles, because there are a lot of justice courts now that use private collection agencies and are very happy in doing so, and I think they're doing a very good job in those circumstances, but it'll get to the point, in some cases anyway, of what you're looking for.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes, Representative Wood.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So just a quick question. How does the cost and the percentage charged by the DOR compare to the rates that are typically found on the open market?
Madam Chair, Representative Wand, I can tell you that based on what we pay, we charge a range of, I believe it's like 12 to 15% for full collections, and we pay a roughly 18 to 20% for private collection firms for accounts that we send out. So,
thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Wan, if I could just comment on that as well. I'm not sure as far as what all the contracts are across the state for justice courts. I'm going to guess they range from somewhere in the low teens to probably the mid 20%. The one thing I would say is that there's a unique law for a lot of these criminal actions where that collection rate can be added to the fine. And so most of these justice courts are being made whole because up to a certain percentage anyway, that rate is being added to the fine.
Excellent. Thank you.
Another question? I have a couple. Alex, it seems to me that the types of fines and violations that would go through justice court are not necessarily some of the easiest to collect on. And I'm wondering about your assumption of 80%. Is that reasonable? Does that,
Representative Berger.
I know you're taking it, you're saying it, but it just seems to me that in this.
Representative Berger, to respond, in fact, I believe they are the easiest to collect. The violations are, at least if you look at OJD's experience with DOR collections, they have a variety of types of fines that they collect, including civil actions, and some of the more, restitution type of counts under a criminal law. Or a criminal case, and those are the lower percentages, and that's why we actually went to fairly, detailed extent here to verify that assumption of 80%, because as I started to look at that particular number, I did get nervous, and in my testimony, recall, I talked about peeling out the violations number. That was from some presentations that were made to the Interim Committee on Justice System Revenue about the experience of collecting different kinds of fines. So given that the vast majority of cases coming out of justice courts are violations, and those tend to be easier to collect, my understanding, than the other kinds of cases that you'd see at a circuit court, for instance.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, just real quickly, I don't know if the 80% is right or not. It seems a little high to me as well. But one thing I wouldn't want people to think is I would be real, it would be hard for me to believe that the 80% would be on all of these cases that he was mentioned before that are 7, 5, 6 years old. I don't think you would ever get that high of a percentage on those cases.
I have this sense, and maybe you can speak to it either now or as I read the bill and contemplate this, that if they're not doing a great job of collections now, the question is why not throwing it at DOR? Some of your statistics are a little appalling, and you kind of would have to ask yourself on this chart why some of these counties can't do this and why the state coming in and rescuing them is a good idea from, what's the barrier to their collections? And that's sort of my fundamental question.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I obviously haven't sat down with all of the justice courts, but it's odd because, you know, we come to the legislature here and everybody fights about whether Department of Revenue or a private collection agency should be collecting on certain debts, and we really need to be focused on how these debts are becoming debts and why they're becoming delinquent and setting up, you know, account receivables management tool for counties and for state agencies and for everybody so that these debts don't become where they're at today. We really shouldn't be fighting over who should be collecting them, but how they don't become delinquent.
I totally agree, and I believe that my co-chair has made that statement exactly, and that we have an overall issue on this debt collection throughout agencies and local government. Further questions from the committee? Anyone else?
Representative Nathanson,
you're here. Would you like to speak on this? We welcome your comments. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Glad to see you.
Members of the committee, I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from District 13. This idea had the unanimous support of the Government Efficiency Task Force, which you've already heard about. The bill, as it's amended, with the very appreciated assistance from the private sector on how to make the bill even better, this bill now accomplishes three purposes. It helps the counties. It helps the state because it improves revenue to both, and now it also does increase accountability and information through the reporting requirement that was added. Justice courts, let me take a step back. We do not actually have a unified court system in Oregon. We have a bifurcated system of courts. We have circuit court system, but we also have a variety of municipal and justice courts around the state. Some counties have different arrangements than other counties. They do not have uniform business practices, and in almost all cases, they don't even have uniform practices in what kinds of topics they handle. From one justice court to another, it may be limited to moving violations, parking. Some include quite a few other kinds of criminal actions. So we have a divided court system without standard practices, without standard accounting. And one of the reasons I think it's important for us to help counties to help themselves is in some of these courts, they just simply don't have the horsepower or the expertise to do this kind of work. They know how to get the business of the justice court working and how to move the cases through, but as far as the business practices, they're probably lacking in sufficient staffing resources and knowledge to take care of these kinds of accounts and collections. Because I think it's real important for counties to be able to help themselves, when we find places where the state is in the way of counties doing their business or justice courts doing their business, I think it's important for us to get out of the way. And I think that's one of the most important things about this bill. This is another area where we recognized, because it was raised to us by local government, was able to take advantage of Department of Revenue collections in some circumstances. Our own circuit courts take advantage of Department of Revenue's collections abilities. Department of Revenue has this entire section and reporting that they do on what they call other agency accounts, how they collect for other agencies. But we were in the way of being able to help them. It's a self-supporting activity of the Department of Revenue. It's not the state giving a subsidy or a handout, if you will, to counties. It's just allowing the justice courts to take advantage of a body of knowledge, of business practices, of expertise that exists in this agency. It will pay for itself. And I felt like it was not a good idea for the state to stand in the way of them being able to do that. And then particularly in discovering that we're talking about revenue that it comes to the state also. When you see that a certain percentage of this revenue is shared with the state, often we're talking about how much the state shares with the counties or with other local governments. In this case, local government has imposed a fine, but in, you might view it as sharing. Some of that comes back to the state. So we are actually foregoing revenue by not helping with the collection practice. And if we enable this assistance for collections, we are then increasing our access to revenue that is owed to the state. I think that's a pretty important thing to take account of. There was a little bit of questioning about justice courts and the business practices, and we do recognize that not all justice courts operate the same. Some of the questions you have, I think, lead to even more fundamental issues of why we have justice courts and what are their practices, but this bill is limited strictly to a specific set of business practices of justice courts. And the larger issue of having a disjointed legal system would be left to another policy committee, I assume. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nathanson. Questions? Yes, Representative Burr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have one question. If this discussion came up, you mentioned the three things that this bill accomplishes, and one of them is increased reporting. But the bill talks about the increased reporting requirement only if they opt in. So is there any discussion about counties purposefully not opting in to not provide that accountability?
Madam Chair and Representative, no, I did not hear that as a possibility or a speculation. I assume that their decision to opt in would be based strictly on could they use the help with getting some additional revenue.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you, Representative Nathanson. Thanks for coming down. Thanks for your work on the Government Accountability Task Force. As usual, you delve deeply into these things, and we appreciate it. Anyone else on this bill? I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2653A, and now we are going to take a very brief recess.
voting cash.
Yeah, it is voting cash. Okay, we are reconvening our House Revenue Committee for today, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2820, which we've already heard. It is the Department of Revenue bill, fee bill. Representative Barnhart, are we ready for a work session?
Do we have the paperwork?
We have to move the dash 1 minute.
Right. Yeah, we have all the paperwork.
We have the paperwork for that one?
And we have to move the dash one.
Now, you're open for...
work session.
2519?
No, 2820.
2820. Yes, Madam Chair. I move the dash one amendment to House Bill 2820.
Representative Barnhart moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2820. Any objection? You object the dash ones?
I do object to the
dash
ones.
Okay. Why don't we take a roll call and make sure we get it on the record?
Aye.
Representative
Gelter.
Aye.
Representative
Reed.
Aye.
Representative
Wong.
Aye.
Representative
Brewer.
Nay.
Barnhart.
Aye.
Aye. The motion carries and the dash one is amended into House Bill 2820, which will change sort of the tagline that goes with it, which would be a very good thing because it is quite deceptive in terms of what the bill says. Representative, we have, I believe, all the paperwork on this, and the our intention is to move this to the Ways and Means Committee.
All right. Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Bonner.
I move House Bill 2820 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and add with the request to add a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Barnhart moves House Bill 2820 as amended with the dash ones recommends to the floor with a due pass recommendation and with the addition of a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any comments? Any questions? Yes.
Just an objection.
Okay, wait a minute. Questions?
Oh, no questions.
Okay. Comment?
Just a quick comment. I can't get there on this one because of the discretion that's given to the department. I'd rather see the legislature keep a handle on any future fee increases, and so I can't get there on this one this time.
Okay. Thank you.
Just a
Representative Benz.
Madam Chair, I have some challenges with this bill. I'm going to vote for it now. I have some questions I will be addressing to the Department of Education while we wait for this to see if it makes its way to the floor.
Thank you.
Just simply to add that one of the things Ways and Means does is look at this whole issue of who gets to decide about fees and the discretion involved in that, and so this is a very appropriate referral for that.
Yes, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's important to point out that a different version of this bill came out of the Subcommittee on Higher Education in the House with very strong support, and that this is a set of fees that was arrived at by consensus by all of the stakeholder groups that worked on putting this together in the interim. It is not a radical product. It's a good work product, and it comes to us in this alternative format because it was stuck in another place for reasons not related to its merits.
Thank you, Representative, for that clarification. Further questions, comments? Carol, shall we roll call, please, vote?
Representative Dent.
Aye.
Representative
Gelson.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative
Vaughn. No.
Representative Bailey.
Aye.
Representative Brewer.
No.
Coach Barnhart.
Aye.
Coach Berger.
Aye. The motion carries, and it goes to our friends in Ways and Means for further consideration. And with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2820 and adjourn. We already carried over
2519.
2653. Oh, okay. We will, then, do I have to open it to carry it over?
Yes.
No. Well, then we will carry over House Bill 2653 till Friday, which is our next meeting. And we have also already carried over 2519, correct? Okay. With those two carried over, we will thank you very much, members of the committee, and close our revenue committee adjourn for the day.